The earliest Aryan people were essentially a people of the voice. The recitation seems to have predominated even in those ceremonial and dramatic dances, and that dressing up, which among most human races have also served for the transmission of tradition. At that time, there was no writing, and when first the art of writing crept into Europe, as we shall tell later, it must have seemed far too slow, clumsy, and lifeless a method of record for men to trouble very much about writing down these glowing and beautiful treasures of the memory. Writing was at first kept for accounts and matters of fact. The bards and rhapsodists flourished for long after the introduction of writing. They survived, indeed, in Europe as the minstrels into the Middle Ages. Unhappily, their tradition hadn't the fixity of a written record. They amended and reconstructed. They had their fashions and their phases of negligence. Accordingly, we've now only the very much altered and revised vestiges of that spoken literature of prehistoric times. One of the most interesting and informing of these prehistoric compositions of the Aryans survives in the Greek Iliad. An early form of Iliad was probably recited by 1000 BC, but it wasn't written down until perhaps 700 or 600 BC. Many men must have had to do with it as authors and improvers, but later Greek tradition attributed it to a blind bard named Homer, to whom also is ascribed the Odyssey, a composition of a very different spirit and outlook. It's possible that many of the Aryan bards were blind men. According to Professor J. L. Myers, their bards were blinded to prevent their straying from the tribe. Mr. L. Lloyd has seen in Rhodesia the musician of a troupe of native dancers who had been blinded by his chief for this very reason. The Slavs called all bards sliepach, which was also their word for a blind man. The original recited version of the Iliad was older than that of the Odyssey. The Iliad, as a complete poem, is older than the Odyssey, though the material of the Odyssey, being largely undateable folklore, is older than any of the historical material in the Iliad. Both epics were probably written over and rewritten at a later date in much the same manner that Lord Tennyson, the poet laureate of Queen Victoria, in his Idylls of the King, wrote over the Mort d'Arthur, which was itself a writing over by Sir Thomas Malory around 1450 of pre-existing legends, making the speeches and sentiments and the characters more in accordance with those of his own time. But the events of the Iliad and the Odyssey, the way of living they describe, the spirit of the acts recorded, belong to the closing centuries of the prehistoric age. These sagas, epics, and Vedas do supply, in addition to archaeology and philology, a third source of information about those vanished times. Here, for example, is the concluding passage of the Iliad, describing very exactly the making of a prehistoric barrow. We've taken here Chapman's rhymed translation, correcting certain words with the help of the prose version of Lang, Leaf, and Myers. Thus oxen, mules, in wagons straight they put, went forth, and an unmeasured pile of sylvan matter cut, 9 days employed in carriage, but when the 10th morn shined on wretched mortals, then they brought the bravest of his kind forth to be burned. Troy swam in tears. Upon the pile's most height they laid the body and gave fire. All day it burned, all night, and when the 11th morn let on earth her rosy fingers shine, the people flocked about the pile, and first with gleaming wine quenched all the flames. His brothers then and friends, the snowy bones, gathered into an urn of gold, still pouring out their moans. Then wrapped they in soft purple veils the rich urn, digged a pit, graved it, built up the grave with stones, and quickly piled on it a barrow. The barrow heaped once all the town, in Jove nursed Priam's court partook a sumptuous funeral feast, and so horse-taming Hector's rites gave up his soul to rest. There remains also an old English saga, Beowulf, made long before the English had crossed from Germany into England, which winds up with a similar burial. The preparation of a pyre is first described. It's hung round with shields and coats of mail. The body is brought and the pyre fired, and then for 10 days the warriors built a mighty mound to be seen afar by the traveller on sea or land. Beowulf, which is at least 1,000 years later than the Iliad, is also interesting because one of the main adventures in it is the looting of the treasures of a barrow, already ancient in those days. Third, the Greek epics reveal the early Greeks with no knowledge of iron, without writing, and before any Greek-founded cities existed in the land into which they had evidently come quite recently as conquerors. They were spreading southward from the Aryan region of origin. They seem to have been a fair people, newcomers in Greece, newcomers to a land that had been held hitherto by the Mediterranean or Iberian peoples. Let's, at the risk of a slight repetition, be perfectly clear upon one point. The Iliad doesn't give us the primitive Neolithic life of that Aryan region of origin. It gives us that life already well on the move towards a new state of affairs. The primitive Neolithic way of living, with its tame and domesticated animals, its pottery and cooking, and its transitory patches of rude cultivation, we've already sketched. Between 15,000 and 6,000 BC, the Neolithic way of living had spread, with the forests and abundant vegetation of the pluvial period, over the greater part of the Old World, from the Niger to the Huang Ho, and from Ireland to the south of India. Now, as the climate of great portions of the earth was swinging towards drier and more open conditions again, the earlier, simpler Neolithic life was developing along two divergent directions. One was leading to a more wandering life, towards at last a constantly migratory life between summer and winter pasture, which is called nomadism. The other, in certain sunlit river valleys, was towards a water-treasuring life of irrigation, in which men gathered into the first towns and made the first civilization. We've already described the first civilizations and their liability to recurrent conquests by nomadic peoples. We've already noted that for many thousands of years there's been an almost rhythmic recurrence of conquest of the civilizations by the nomads. Here we have to note that the Greeks, as the Iliad presents them, are neither simple Neolithic nomads, innocent of civilization, nor are they civilized men. They're nomads in an excited state, because they've just come upon civilization and regard it as an opportunity for war and loot. These early Greeks of the Iliad are sturdy fighters, but without discipline. Their battles are a confusion of single combats. They have horses, but no cavalry. They use the horse, which is a comparatively recent addition to Aryan resources, to drag a rude fighting chariot into battle. The horse is still novel enough to be something of a terror in itself. For ordinary draft purposes, as in the quotation from the Iliad we've just made, oxen were employed. The only priests of these Aryans are the keepers of shrines and sacred places. There are chiefs who are heads of families and who also perform sacrifices, but there doesn't seem to be much mystery or sacramental feeling in their religion. When the Greeks go to war, these heads and elders meet in council and appoint a king whose powers are very loosely defined. There are no laws, but only customs, and no exact standards of conduct. The social life of the early Greeks centered about the households of these leading men. There were no doubt huts for herds and the like, and outlying farm buildings, but the hall of the chief was a comprehensive center to which everyone went to feast, to hear the bards, to take part in games and exercises. The primitive craftsmen were gathered there. About it were cowsheds and stabling and such like offices. Unimportant people slept about anywhere as retainers did in the medieval castles, and as people still do in Indian households. Except for quite personal possessions, there was still an air of patriarchal communism about the tribe.